Well, as I mentioned, last month we talked with our weather guys about those high 90-degree temperatures here in Wisconsin. Today we'll ask about the heat waves in other countries with our guest John Martin, one of our weather guys. Steve Ackerman, not with us today. He's off out west?
Wilds of Wyoming.
The wilds of Wyoming. Okay, so he won't be with us, but John's here. John's a professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. And we will talk with him about the heat waves, but also answer your weather-related questions as well. And I hope you'll join the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. John, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here as always.
There's been some record-breaking temperatures in many parts of the globe in recent weeks. What's been going on?
Well, you know, we're at the hottest time of the year. Last couple of weeks of July, first day or two of August, just about everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere experiences its record high temperature sometime in that time frame. So this is a normal circumstance to get really extreme temperatures. However, some of the extremes that we have recently seen have never been seen in those locations. London was one of them. I think places near New Delhi and India have had a terrible, prolonged heat wave this summer. So this is definitely a combination, it seems to me, of a normal circumstance that would always occur, exacerbated by the global warming that's going on. And so we're ending up with some really unbearable situations for lots of different parts of the world.
Well, in England, I mean, they're typically homes don't even have air conditioning.
That's correct. I mean, and imagine if it's 105 degrees and you don't have air conditioning, you're going to suffer. And it's a very hard situation to deal with in terms of comfort.
So what causes a heat wave?
Well,
and what is a heat wave is what I forget is 5 days.
Yeah, there's a duration criteria and a temperature in excess of the local the time average for a given period of time. So I don't know what the deviation is, but it is a 5 day period of excessive heat. And so one of the things about heat waves is that they are related to sort of stationary weather patterns. They don't move very much, quite unlike what we get in the wintertime where things are changing every third day.
Yeah.
So in the summertime, when you're in a heat wave, you are stuck in the middle of something that's about a 10-day long duration. So how do they form is a really excellent question. We're trying to understand as much more of that as we can. I think in the past, heat waves have been considered just episodic. I don't think we've tried to link the regional scale, let's say 10 states in the Midwest scale, to the broader climate scale or the broader planetary wave scale and really understand where they come from. We're beginning to do that now. In fact, colleagues of mine and I are writing a proposal that's going to look at one aspect of that. And heat waves will be one of the phenomena that's related to what we're going to investigate. But the big necessary condition is a giant clockwise region of flow called a ridge in the Northern Hemisphere that builds up. And it builds up when the jet stream migrates poleward, which is... it's always inching poleward in the summertime, but occasionally it gets really big undulations in it that make it bulge poleward in certain longitude bands. And in those longitude bands where a big ridge is developed, a couple of things happen. One is the floodgates to the tropics are opened right up. There's nothing prohibiting tropical type air to make it all the way into central and northern Canada. That's one thing. The skies stay clear. And with the tropical air making a poleward surge, that, you know, the other night, was it Saturday or Friday night? You felt that incredible humidity. You walk outside late at night, it's 80 degrees, and you can feel the air almost radiating to you. That overnight low is going to be, it's not going to go down anywhere. So you'll stay in the mid to high 70s in a heat wave overnight low. The fact that the skies are clear in association with the overlying ridge for the next day means you start out warming up from sunshine at 78 degrees. And of course, you're going to get into the 90s. Same thing the next night. If it stays humid, you're not going to cool down. Then the skies are clear, so the next day you get sunshine again. It brings you up into the 90s, and it keeps on going until that giant ridge, which is a fairly stationary feature, is eventually broken down by other features in the hemispheric flow, and it takes a long time to do that.
So do heat waves in one hemisphere cause cooled conditions in another hemisphere?
That's a reasonable question, but I think the answer is we don't have any suspicion that that should be the case, because the hemispheres operate, especially at the peak seasons, peak winter in the southern hemisphere now, peak summer in the northern hemisphere, they operate fairly independently of one another. I think there's more likely to be interactions between the hemispheres and maybe some causation from one to the other in what we call the shoulder seasons, the ones that are outside of the heat and the cold. So probably spring and fall are a little bit more commonly times where the hemispheres might interact. Not so much dead of the winter, dead of the summer.
Hmm. John Martin, our guest today, give a call with your weather or climate question. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@WPR.org. So just go back to the UK, although I think Spain and Portugal were having 117 degrees or something.
Yeah,
like
places in Central Valley of Spain. Madrid, I think, broke its all-time high, probably also in Portugal. Keep in mind how skinny Portugal is.
Yeah.
It's got the Atlantic Ocean on the west coast, and, I don't know how many miles inland before you get to the Spanish border, but it's not really a wide country. And to have so there's not a lot of geography differences except for the ocean and the inland. So it's hard to imagine, a number of all-time high records breaking in the small country of Portugal. It's a little easier to understand it in Spain, but brutal hot weather in Iberia over the last 4 weeks leading up to now.
115, 116 degrees.
And, highs over 100 in Madrid are not that uncommon, but the difference between 100 and 115 is extraordinary in terms of human comfort, and especially there because the humidity, it's on the northwest side of the Mediterranean. It's impossible to keep it dry and hot for very long in those places.
Let's take a call. Angie in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Angie. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was just curious if you could elaborate on why the northern and southern hemispheres act independently in the peak summer and winter seasons, like you just said.
Yeah, I don't know if this is extremely well established, but it's a problem that's not attracted any research attention because it's probably not such a strong interaction. But one of the reasons is in the winter hemisphere, whether it's the northern or the southern, and right now it's the southern hemisphere experiencing its winter, the jet stream is really revved up in the cold hemisphere, and it pushes toward the equator, and it really bottles up all the weather is poleward of the jet stream in both hemispheres almost all the time, extratropical weather, that is. And so in the southern hemisphere summer, winter, which is going on right now, the southern hemisphere jet stream is pretty close to the equator. It's probably down to 35 degrees south or something like that, 30 degrees south. And that is going to be the boundary at which all other weather phenomena in the southern hemisphere going all the way up to the South Pole are going to be strongly bounded by that feature. So that is already leaving it 30 degrees shy of the equator, which would be the entry point for interaction with the northern hemisphere. And meanwhile, in the northern hemisphere summer, its jet stream has migrated well into central Canada on average. And so much of the weather that you would see associated with the northern pole, any cool weather and wet extratropical type disturbances migrate well to the north. So the gap, the distance between extratropical disturbances in the northern hemisphere and those in the southern hemisphere is largest during the peak winter or peak summer time. And it shrinks a little bit as the jets recede, as the jets change their latitude in both hemispheres and tropical cyclones are introduced in one or the other of the hemispheres. It can be a little more interaction then. But that's a fall and a spring event, not a winter and summer event.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it very much. And we're getting, in the States, where right now we're getting some miserable stuff out on the East Coast, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's brutally hot there. It's quite like what we had here Saturday and Friday. And then, weather systems, though they make slower progress to the east in the summertime usually than they do in the wintertime, they still make that progress. And then you've got the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf Stream, the warmest Atlantic Ocean water in the hemisphere, adjacent to flow from the southwest. So it gets warm and really muggy in the northeast.
I was thinking about my own circumstance because a tree limb fell down across the street,
right?
And took out my power at the house. I mean, just completely knocked everything off.
Oh, that's terrible.
So we've had 5 days without power.
5 days, and that includes the weekend. that we just passed. Oh, Larry, I feel bad for you.
Well, I was gone until yesterday. I happened to be up north, and so I didn't get back, although there was a lot of phoning and stuff going on to try and line up an electrician to come to the house. The electricians are very busy right now.
I imagine they are, yeah.
I thank you, Westfall Electric. they're right now at my home.
That's excellent.
Fixing it up. And
that's current events in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, current events in a manner of speaking. And for me, the best part was my former wife was minding this home.
Mm.
And she said that because when we did the remake of the house, we made it an Energy Star home.
Oh, yeah.
And so it remained cool even
That's
through.
That's great, because Saturday was brutal. We were in and out of our house during the day, and every time coming in with the AC on was a relief like you can't describe. It was great.
Oh, man. John Martin, our guest today, as we talk with him about climate and weather. We talked about the record heat in Europe, especially, but also in India. And looking forward to your questions. You may have questions about that or other questions as well about weather, maybe something going on in your neighborhood. Give a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with John Martin. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about weather right now on the show, weather and climate. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. John Martin, our guest, one of our weather guys. He's a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Always great to have him come by. And we're talking about the weather and climate. So what questions you have? You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email, the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Just a comment on the heat waves. NOAA has analyzed the number of heat waves per year over the last 10, 15 years, I forget exactly, and it was statistically significant higher number of heat waves now than 5 years ago even.
Yeah, and this harkens back to something you said earlier, Larry, about the trying to define what a heat wave is, and there are formal definitions. One of them is a duration criteria. One is a threshold above average criteria for a daily temperature, and then you have to meet it several days in a row. And it's not surprising to hear this result. I wasn't aware of it until you said it, but it's not surprising because if you add just a little increment of increased temperature to the background state, there are going to be a lot more days that probably meet a threshold that is X degrees above normal for that day, and that probably puts you in position then to have a heat wave. And I was using the example when we were chatting about it. Steve and I have a couple of goofy metrics to measure the intensity of various seasons. One of them for the summer is how many 90-degree days do you get in Madison? The average is 13 for a summer, but the record is 39. And but in a couple of, was it 2013, I think we, or 2012, we had 36 or 35. But in that same year, we had 5 or 6 89s. So if we had just been 1 degree higher, in fact, it might have been for a fraction of a degree because the actual high may have been 89.3 at the airport on one of those days. So, you know, if you get that little bit of extra that comes from the background warming, suddenly you're talking about 41 days you had over 90, and it sounds like an unbelievable record. And of course it is, but that's the interplay between the background real climate and then the man-made induced slight change to the climate that can put you over some of the thresholds.
John in Rice Lake, we'll go to you. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is kind of a little off topic of the heat waves, but years ago, I was up in the Boundary Waters. It was probably the end of August, early September, about a 75-degree day. And it was clear skies all day, all morning, all afternoon. And about 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon, still clear skies, I could see flashes of lightning off in the distance, you know, on, right on the horizon. And I watched, and it was moving at a pretty rapid rate of speed, and it was pretty much heading right toward me. And but it was strange because there was not one cloud in any direction on the horizon that you could see, except this one cloud, and it was small. And it kept approaching and approaching, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be in trouble because I'm up on a bluff with nothing but large white pine trees. Mm. But it all of a sudden it made a 90-degree turn. I would guess it was probably 3 or 4 miles away, and it just made a 90-degree turn and headed off in a different direction.
Mm.
But it never changed size or anything. There was lightning bolts heading skyward and to the ground. Constantly, and it was probably 2 or 3 flashes a second.
Wow.
The entire time I watched it. You know, I watched it for a good half hour, and there again, there was no clouds the rest of the evening or anything else anywhere to be seen.
Yeah, very, very interesting, and probably relatively rare, but certainly the atmosphere plays lots of tricks in its hand all the time. One of the things that comes to mind for me in such a case as that is that there may have just been a broad, widespread, what we call a cap on the lower part of the atmosphere. So there's instability that can cook up in the atmosphere during the daytime heating, even as late as August, September. And if there's a cap on top of that instability that's cooking up, it will never be realized in the form of a vertically developing cloud, which can lead then to a thunderstorm. But it doesn't take more than a little bit of a gap, and it could be the size of a one square acre or something, one little gap in that otherwise pervasive cap that stands on top of the daytime heating in the boundary layer that can allow one place to become a spot where the cooked up instability will manifest itself in a deep cloud. And as soon as that happens, that cloud takes on a life of its own, and it does all of the things that a whole collection of deep thunderstorm clouds would do. And so it can be producing ice and lightning and all the other things that you see. I don't have a really good understanding of why it would have just taken a 90-degree right turn, unless the right turn was an apparent turn, in the sense that what happened was that storm itself was not the same one in the whole half hour. It may have been redeveloping slightly to the right of where the original one was, and it would easily, to the naked eye, appear as though it's the same storm. On a radar display, it might be more easy to determine that this is regeneration of new storms along a line. And that might make it look like, from a stationary observer's point of view, that it's turning to the right or to the left. But I'm not going to say that's the case, but it could be the case. That's one thing that does happen occasionally. But usually, with a collection of thunderstorms, the unitary nature of this thing is very unusual. And yet I've seen that happen here in town once, memorably in late July of, I think it was 98 or 99, we had a tremendous afternoon flood for an isolated thunderstorm. Bigger scale than the one I think you're talking about, John, but it's nonetheless the same kind of thing.
Interesting. John, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Sue in Bailey's Harbor. I was just there a couple days ago, as a matter of fact.
Place.
Sue emailed to ask, what is causing all the extreme wind we seem to be having all the time? And I can vouch for the fact there was a lot of wind in Bailey's Harbor in that area of Door County.
Well, you know, Door County is a peninsula that sticks out into a relatively cold body of water, and we're in the heat of the summertime with a lot of clear skies lately. So the sea breeze is a really active phenomena along the whole spine of the county, and it's going to have diurnal and local intensities and places when it's really strong, times when it's really strong, and then times where it weakens. And on top of that, the peninsula is pretty hilly, and so there's going to be local wind phenomena just from the hills and the valleys. So when you put it all together, it's probably a pretty breezy place. And then if there's a passage of a weather system, and we're far enough north that we still get the southern end of cold fronts trailing through here in late July and August, that you can get something of a cyclone scale that will add to that local windiness. So without knowing all the data and seeing, you know, is it really a pervasive trend, or is it just this particular summer that seems windy? Sometimes perceptions can lead us to the conclusions that are not quite backed up by the data. But those are some of the factors that could play into it up in that part of the state.
I was blaming the wind on a few errant golf balls shots.
Well, who wouldn't do that, Larry? I mean, who wouldn't do that? I blame the woods for being in the wrong place.
Oh, man. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Is Wisconsin looking like it will set some records this summer, do you think?
That is a good question. I thought for sure we had our sights on being in the top 3 to 5, perhaps even the all-time, of number of 90-degree days. Surprise in Madison. So I'm going to restrict this first comment to Madison, because we had 10 by the time we got to June 18th or something like that. And that, to that date on the calendar, was the all-time record this year. It stopped. We've had about 2 or 3 since. So we hadn't piled them up in the month of July like I thought we might. And I suspect that's probably true generally across the state. So at least from the perspective of number of hot days above a certain temperature, we may not have approached any records this summer. I don't know if I've heard too much about tornadic activity yet in our state. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's an August phenomena as opposed to a July phenomena. It's almost never a June phenomena in terms of frequency of tornadoes. Big ones have happened in June. But number of storms, having quite a number of them, is more of a July and August thing. So I don't know. It may just be one of these things, these stealthy sort of climate change-based temperature things. Overnight lows don't get as low. The daytime highs, maybe you don't see anything, and we're all awake during the daytime. When you take the average temperature, it's fractionally higher than it used to be. And you wonder, and you say, what's going on? I don't think we've had many 90-degree days. It's that we've had overnight lows at 73 to 75, perhaps more frequently than we used to. And that's not only a human comfort issue, but of course it's an energy issue if you're air conditioning your house. You need to use it more under those conditions.
Mike called. He couldn't stay with us, but he would like you to compare today's extreme weather and that of extreme weather of the 30s.
I wasn't alive in the 30s, surprisingly to some people I know. but I would say this. The Dust Bowl 1936 was a brutally hot year in the central part of the United States. Both North and South Dakota set their all-time minimum temperatures for the year for the state and their all-time maximum temperatures for the state in 1936. Madison's all-time high was on July 13th, 1936. I think it was 107. People were sleeping outside of their homes around on the Capitol Square because they couldn't stand to be in their non-air-conditioned homes over that period of time, mid-July 1936. I think about that a lot because I don't think there was any prohibition against mosquitoes in 1936. They were, of course, out in force. Imagine coming to the conclusion that it's more comfortable to sleep swatting mosquitoes all night than to be in your own home. Unbelievable. So I think there have been episodes in the past where the extreme weather that we talk about, and this summer it's been discomfort in heat and humidity, that's easily been equaled, perhaps even surpassed, in the fairly recent past. However, there are new risks that seem to be exacerbated in a way by the climate change and other things in a way that we haven't seen before. I don't think we've seen such extraordinary frequency of giant forest fires, for instance. And that's a new thing. We haven't seen quite the number of human fatalities due to heat waves that we see now. That could be a function of population and other things as well, but it certainly is a function of heat and humidity. So in terms of some of the unfortunate deliverables of the extreme weather, we may be in an era we haven't seen before. But I think when you look at just the meteorological data, a case could be made that things have been at least as bad, sometimes worse, in other recent eras.
Ron in Hortonville, we'll go to you. Hi, Ron.
Good afternoon. I just want to preface this by saying I'm not a climate denier, but I'd like just to have a little better understanding how a couple of degrees change can have such a huge impact. So, just taking it down to earth, what really difference does it make if it's 18 degrees or 20 degrees on a polar ice cap? Maybe you could help me with that.
Yeah, well, it might not matter in certain ranges. That's a very good point. I mean, there's going to be some places that are, not really susceptible to substantial changes to the way things work in those places due to a 2-degree global average temperature rise. That's a very good point. However, there's a lot of things that do depend on that. Agriculture over the whole, arable land in the Northern Hemisphere will be affected by slightly higher temperatures, slightly higher water vapor contents in the air will have something to do with how much precipitation is delivered in individual storms, both in the winter and in the summertime. There'll also be changes where we're figuring some of this stuff out now. there's changes in the jet stream configurations, which carry along with them weather systems, both in the summer and in the wintertime. And so the distribution and the frequency at a given location with which cyclones and rain-producing storms may pass by will change in some substantial ways. All of these things can be traced back to those really small changes in the global average temperature. And it sounds impossible to believe. But if you've ever looked at any complicated machine and you say to yourself, what if I just change the radius of this particular, you know, little gear that's in there by a little fraction? And you'd say then the whole machine wouldn't work the same way. And I think people have an easier time understanding that kind of thing than they do saying, why does 2 degrees temperature difference matter so much? And because I think that is a reasonable question. It's just that 2 degree temperature change manifests itself in all manner of other small changes in the whole nature of the atmosphere and ocean circulations. And that is what drives lots of the changes that we are now seeing, not only predicting, but also seeing. Some of the things we're seeing today were predicted 20 years ago. None of the things that people who are skeptics, and I know, sir, you say you're not, those who are skeptics now, it's curious that they're not making predictions because they don't want to say what they think is going to happen next because their theory of there isn't anything going on is completely bunk. And it's dangerous to build any predictions on something that you don't and refuse to try to understand. So we're trying to understand it, and I think we're gonna do better and better as we go forward on that.
Yeah, Ron, thanks a lot. Appreciate that call. Donna in Hartford, will go to you next. Hi, Donna. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. It's such a pleasure to speak with you all. I am about a 45-year long person who's had interest in weather. That takes me back to age 11, when I was petrified of thunderstorms. And my mother cleverly bought me a weather book put out by our local meteorologist on Channel 4, Paul Joseph, and I educated myself in clouds and weather and became the household, you know, weather girl. and subsequently calmed myself down, you know, with big storms. But one thing I remember about big storms years ago, similar to the one that just went through Saturday night, was there was a vast temperature change the next day. And that was very commonplace after a system would go through.
Yeah.
And I don't remember maybe even the last 20 years, having such a drastic temperature change following that cold front, where we'd go from, you know, mid-90s down to, like, 50s for the daytime high. And I wondered if you could explain, does climate change have anything to do with that, or what affects that?
That's a good question. I think, are you reporting, though, Donna, that you went from the 90s on Saturday to the 50s on Sunday?
No.
Oh, okay.
But what I'm saying is I remember as a kid, you know, just, you know, it would be so hot and humid and you could barely, you know, catch a breeze anywhere, feel any coolness. And the next day you'd be out playing in jeans and a sweatshirt because it was so chilly outside.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Because I have the same memory. I remember that. And one of the things that's quite curious about summertime thunderstorms, I grew up in Massachusetts, so it's approximately the same latitude as Milwaukee. And so, you know, you have this notion that in the summertime, before a cold front passes through your locale, you can be really hot and humid like we were here on Saturday. And then when the front comes by, there are different intensities to fronts. And if it's midsummer or let's say peak of the summer, like it was this weekend, July 23rd, 24th, that front's going to be a lot weaker than one you get even a month later. When we get a frontal passage in August 23rd, 24th, that's the kind you're remembering, I think. And they still occur that way. We'll have a hot day in August 22nd of 92 degrees, dew point is 70. The next day, the temperature will struggle to see 70. And we'll have, you know, the water will evaporate immediately as soon as the dry air moves in before the sun even comes up, and it'll feel like a fall day. You know, that first fall day feeling in late August is usually after a thunderstorm day because it's a cold front coming in, and it's the first really autumnal cold front of the year. So those are probably not been affected where we live very much by climate change, except insofar as the humidity and the temperature before they pass might be higher than it used to be when we were kids, but only fractionally. Hard to really notice that. And I think you'll still get those almost 35-degree temperature drop types of frontal passages. You almost never get them in July, but you frequently get them in late August and into mid and late September. It's very common.
Ah.
So they're still coming.
They're still coming, Donna. Thank you so much for calling. Well, let's talk about thunderstorms. We had a number of them going through the state this weekend.
Yeah.
What was causing the weather pattern?
That was a sort of a pre-frontal, almost. It was a little bit ahead of the cold front, because the real drying from our Saturday-Sunday event didn't come in until late in the morning Sunday. And you could begin then finally to feel it. I was at the ball game yesterday in Milwaukee, and it was a lot more humid in Milwaukee, even post-frontal, than it was in Madison when we finally got home. So there is a little bit of a variation in how quickly the humidity dropped behind the front. It was all northwesterly flow the whole day, and Milwaukee too. So that was an example of sort of a flabby, not well put together front. And despite that fact, the thunderstorms on its leading edge on Saturday were really quite intense. And they were the intensity was highly variable. We, at my particular place in west side of Madison, we didn't get any severe winds. We had a couple of really vivid lightning strikes, but no severe winds, no branches down. And people just a few miles away said, oh, it was like a cataclysm. It was like June 13th all over again with all the, you know, big trees down. So it was hit or miss, depending on exactly where you were. But that was a thunderstorm line that was out ahead of what turns out to be a fairly weak cold front. It's not surprising that it's weak in late July. So
somebody else wonders, how does lightning form?
Lightning, I think what happens in clouds is that there's a separation of charge that's encouraged by the presence of ice in the cloud. So deep thunderstorm cloud, even though what falls out of it is a raindrop, it's a melted piece of ice by the time it gets there, because the clouds are probably 55 to 75,000 feet deep.
Yeah.
And so way up there, the temperatures are well below freezing. And when pieces of ice are rubbing against each other in the friction of a thunderstorm with all of the updrafts and downdrafts, that separates charges to positives and negatives in the cloud. And that separation then allows for discharge. So there's a little bit of insulation about the charge separation in the atmosphere naturally, but it's not difficult to overpower that insulation. And when that insulation is insufficient, boom, you get a lightning discharge to kind of even things out. And the same can happen with the ground. Forget what the polarity of the ground is, but it's opposite what it is at the base of a thunderstorm cloud. And so when that potential builds up past the threshold, boom, you get a discharge.
Yeah, and that was the follow-up was the earlier caller said, we're talking about the one cloud and mentioned the lightning going up and coming down, and the person wondered if, does lightning really go up as well as down?
Well, you do have, I would consider it this way. I think when they show really high speed, then slowed down versions of it, sometimes it looks like this, the leader goes up from the ground. But I'm not a lightning expert. But there is such a thing as cloud-to-ground lightning strikes, and then cloud-to-cloud lightning strikes. So people sometimes see that, ones that bridge two clouds. And then there's in-cloud lightning strikes, where all you see is a general purple glow to the cloud, and that's an in-cloud lightning strike.
Well, on that note, we are out of time, John. Boy, this went fast.
Yeah, it did.
I'm sorry we didn't get to Alice's comment, but you'll be back the last Monday of next month?
Yes, sir. See you
then. Good Lord willing and the creek don't rise. Yeah. Too much,
that's
as they used to say.
That's right.
John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Of course, he's a professor in that department right now. He'll be back probably with Steve Ackerman. He'll be back from Wyoming by then. And Patricia McConnell back with us to talk about the difference between behavior management and training with your dog, and also look at whether dogs understand apologies. That'll be tomorrow on the show. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.